call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up a informational meeting on getting an update on Kever, Oregon.
Where's the media?
It is, this is a, I understand the second shot you're having at this, so you should be able to get it right the second time, Clark.
We're going to try.
I do just want to make a point.
I think we're not interesting enough.
Before we start, I've noted the confusion, it seems to me, between the issue of the extent to which we've moved to the federal plan for the IT system, or we've just moved to the federal exchange. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very important point. It's got everybody, I think, confused, and I hope you'll focus on that to a certain extent in today's presentation. Mm-hmm. I do remember talking to you before the board met, when the board met, being quite sure we were talking about an IT decision.
Right.
And not necessarily talking about a decision on the future of Kever, Oregon. I hope today we'll keep those things straight so we can understand what you're talking about in that context. And that's the only piece of background I have. You're here in response to a amendment to a Senate bill that we passed in the last session, and I appreciate you being here. I'm sorry you had to do it twice. I'm sorry. Figure out a better way to do it in the future. You're not the only double booking on the agenda today. So please introduce yourself and have at it.
All right. Well, this is Tina Edlin next to me.
She looked very familiar.
Yes.
She used to work for OHA.
That's why she's here. She's helping out. I'm Clyde Hamstreet, and for many of those who haven't met me, I'm the principal of Hamstreet & Associates. It's a turnaround and restructuring firm based in Portland, but we work all around the United States. We specialize in going into companies, usually businesses, sometimes other organizations, that are having serious financial or organizational problems. We have a good track record of going in, trying to figure out what's wrong, and come up with a plan to fix it, and we're often charged with doing that fix. I know a lot about organizations and businesses. I don't have a lot of policy experience when it comes to healthcare. So Tina's will probably step in and keep me on track a few times. And if there's some questions that neither one of us can answer, we'll go back and get the answer and give it to you as soon as we can. With that, we'll start talking about leadership changes. I think there's been a lot of changes since the last time. Well, many of you talked about Kever, Oregon. Representative Greenleck in the chair has been following us pretty carefully. But the changes since the end of March are Alex Pettit, the state CIO, has been made the interim Kever, Oregon CIO. I was appointed the interim executive director by the board of Kever, Oregon on April 10th. Tina Edlin is the new transition project director. She's not a Kever, Oregon person. She now reports directly to the governor, and we'll go through that in part of this presentation because there's a lot of overlap between what she's doing and what the rest of us are doing. Mark Schmidt is one of my people, and he's the interim COO. Started April 10th, he started a little bit later than that. And we created a new position, CFO, for Kever, Oregon, and one of my people is there on an interim basis, Sue King. Today, we're going to cover the requirements of SB 1562 and discussing enrollments, premiums paid, and administrative fees. And then we want to talk a little bit about the progress we're making at Kever, Oregon, and how we're dealing with the challenges that we've identified, particularly focusing on the technology restructuring and the business restructuring. And we'll talk a little bit about 2015. The SB 1562 requirements say we're supposed to provide some demographic information on individuals who enrolled, the number of individuals enrolled who paid premiums, and also talk a little bit about the administrative charge. I'll start off by saying that enrollment I think is good, considering that our IT system didn't come. It's not working well. It's part of it's working, but a lot of it's not. When Cover Oregon found out that it couldn't use a web page to enroll people directly, they had to create a hybrid process. And that hybrid process was taking the core of the technology that did work, adding a lot of people with it, and these people had to be trained how to go in and access the system to make the changes and complete the applications. It required a lot of redeployment of full-time staff and a large addition of temporary staff, most of that taking place here in Salem. Still, with all those hardships, in 5 months, there was a lot of dedicated by a large number of people. The enrollment, I think, is the numbers are good. And we'll go through those numbers now. You'll notice on some of these slides have a different date. May 27th is the most recent. Total medical enrollments is 285,000 for Cover Oregon that came through the Cover Oregon process. Almost 84,000 of those are QHP, and the 202,000 of them are OHA enrollments through mostly Medicaid. And then Fast Track through OHA enrolled another 137,000. So total medical enrollments are 422,000. The next slide is on demographics. And these are as of May 15th, so there's a slight variation. And we're showing 82,000 enrollments here. 44% are male, and 56.5% are female. By the tiers, metal tier, bronze are 23%, silver 65%, gold 10%, platinum 1%, and catastrophic 1%. Under the Senate bill, we're supposed to provide information of how many of the enrollees got financial assistance, and that worked out to be 80%. 20% did not get any financial assistance. And then we're supposed to break it down by age. And again, these are as of May 15th. Less than 18 years of age is 4.6%. 18 to 25, 7.3. 26 to 34, 15.5%. 35 to 44, 15.8. And then as the age gets older, the percentage goes up. 45 to 54, 20%, and 55 to 64, 35.8%, and those older 65 are just half a percentage point. So the way to consider whether these enrollments are good or not is to take a look at the raw numbers compared to other states. So what we have here, we have two columns. The first column is comparing Oregon to all the states and District of Columbia. So there's 51 reports.
Clyde, this is QHP enrollment, huh?
This is QHP enrollment. Yes, sir. Thank you. And then we have compared to other state-based exchanges. There's 15 states that are state-based exchanges. And on total enrollment... Both. It's both. It's QHP and Medicaid enrollments, OHA.
Oh, that'd be great.
So you see under the total enrollment, we have qualified health plan. On a national level, we were 28 of the 51. On a state SBM basis, we were 7th of 15. And then on the Medicaid enrollments, we were 5th in the 51 reports. And we were 5th in the state-based reports. Then, as a percentage of population, which I think is probably a better way to judge, because of the some states are twice as big, or 10 times bigger than Oregon. Many states are much larger. Qualified health plan compared to the 51 reports, we were 36th, about the middle of the road, a little less than that, and then. Compared to our health-based exchanges, SBMs, we were 9th out of 15th. In Medicaid, though, we were much better at 6 out of 51 in both measurements between the SBMs and on the total reports. The next slide is premiums paid. And the premiums paid, and these numbers are a little bit smaller than the other numbers because of the reporting time lag. When someone enrolls, they have a certain amount of time to send their check in before they become qualified, so there's a little bit of a lag here. But as of May 15th, the premiums that have been paid were 76.977% of the people enrolled. We think as the later enrollments get accounted for, this number will go up some. When we did these slides, we weren't able to find any numbers that are provided by the federal government as to how we compare to other states. What data we did find is that consultants are estimating the national average might be 80%. And then the last piece of information we're supposed to provide are the administration fees. These were set by the board. The fees for 2014 were set at 938, and then on the April board meeting, they approved a slight increase in the fees to 966 per member per month. These fees are, once Cover Oregon was set up and running, were going to be the main source of revenue for its operations.
Mr. Chair, could I interrupt? I know I just walked in, but did you just say that, may I ask a question now?
Sure.
Thank you.
And you have in front of you the numbers of the slides that he presented
beforehand.
Okay.
Thank you. The administration fees, that is what?
When someone enrolls in insurance, let's say someone enrolls a family of three in insurance, they buy their insurance from Kaiser. Each month, Kaiser charges, as part of the insurance premium, we charge them an administrative fee, much like an insurance agent will. If an insurance agent sells his insurance for auto insurance to a family, they get a fee for doing that. Not an agent commission, but a fee. So it's similar here. The idea was under the law that a fee would be collected as an administrative fee for doing the transactions on the benefit of the insurance carriers. And then that's part of their billing. So it comes from, in that case, since there would be three times that monthly fee for each month people are paying for their insurance.
There'll be three.
Because there's three lives.
Okay. I see. In your example, there's three people.
Yes.
So the in 2014, the fee was $938 per month.
Yes.
For what? For
remember.
Enrolling, no, I get that part. I'm just wondering what the consumers are getting for this.
Let's get to this question, but when we started, we asked them to make sure they separated the question of the IT system for entry and the question of managing the exchange. So we're going to talk about it as we get to the plans for the future, what the difference between those two pieces are.
Well, and I understand that, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to defer the question, but I'd like to get the answer because, as I remember it, and I actually remember the bill, and I remember the models that we were shown, the fee was to permit Cover Oregon to become self-sustaining. But I'm a little puzzled why the fee would go from $938 per member per month, not an insignificant additional cost for a family of three, in your example, to $966 per member per month when we're now going to the federal exchange.
Well, we're not going to the federal exchange. I think that's the issue. We're using the federal entry system. But my assumption is we haven't made a decision yet on whether we're going to the federal exchange for the management of the exchange. My assumption is we are going to continue to manage the exchange, but That's one of the things I hope we'll find out in this report.
Okay. I have a couple of follow-up questions that I'd like to get answered.
I think a lot of this will be answered as we go through the report. So I don't have a slide on this, but when we first got there, we started looking around, like we look at any business, to try to make some quick assessments. And it was clear to us that there was that the technology wasn't doing the job. Everybody knew that. We didn't have to be smart to figure that out. But we did have to say, okay, what is it we're supposed to be doing? What is Cover Oregon's job? What is going on here? And it was clear to me that the purpose of Cover Oregon, as I understand it, was to recruit potential customers, and if they could enroll them, then they would sell them insurance. And so the real process that was going on in Cover Oregon was processing applications. People wanted to enroll. And there was either Cover Oregon, I mean, it was either OHP through the through OHA's Medicaid program, or it was QHP through the qualified health plans. And they, as I, we put that together, Cover Oregon put that system together, but there was a lot of work to do, and it was taking a lot of people to do it. So we said, okay, we've got to fix the technology. Second thing was, because of all the effort on there, the business systems weren't working properly, and we went through a lot of that. But the point of it is, it came to me that Cover Oregon's responsibility of taking care of both Medicaid and QHP was bigger than Cover Oregon was going to be able to do. I met Tina about a week after I'd been there, and we started talking about this, and this is bigger than Cover Oregon. It's a more of a state-type project. We have to take care of how we're going to take care of Medicaid. We have to take care of how we're going to take care of the technology for the Cover Oregon. We have these business issues. And out of that came the idea that we needed to treat this as a project as opposed just to a Cover Oregon thing. And when the board voted to change it, use the technology, and that was their vote, was to use the technology for processing these applications. Then we went to Washington, D.C., five of us did, and we came up with we went back there with a plan, and part of that plan was to have a project leader, and the governor named Tina that leader. And so Tina's going to take us a little bit about this project, which kind of helps explain what the workload is and how we're solving some of these problems for Cover Oregon in the future. So with that, Tina.
I think you still have some slides here, right?
I went through them.
Okay, you went through everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on April 25th, the board made a decision to go to use the federal technology as first I should introduce myself. For the record, my name is Tina Edlund. I'm the technology project director for the governor's office on this project. The board made their decision on the 25th of April to move to the federal technology. As Chair Greenlick said, this was just a decision to use their technology for eligibility determinations and enrollment for the qualified health plans. It wasn't a decision to give up any of the plan management functions that Cover Oregon engages in, the selection of plans, the certifications of plans, the rate review process that the state has within its insurance division. It was just the IT piece. When I asked the governor what his expectations were of me, he said, well, we want a operating website that Oregonians can go to and apply for and get health insurance coverage in a single sitting by November 15th of 2014. I'm going to get up to this slide here. So what I hope when I go through my part of this presentation today, I hope that what you'll come away with is the idea that we're making progress. We're moving forward on this project to move the technology from, first of all, for the carriers, the local carriers, to connect to the federal technology solution, and for Medicaid, the Medicaid eligibility system to be moved from from Cover Oregon to OHA. Again, this is all, I'm very, very focused on November 15th. To get to that kind of a goal, you really do, you have to have a focused team as well. And you have to have a single point. That, I mean, as the real data report pointed out, that you have to have clear lines of authority, clear accountability. You have to have a good governance structure. So we've really focused on that in these beginning days of this project. We put together a team. We put together the governance structure. I'll talk a little bit about that. I am the single point of accountability, reporting directly to the governor on making sure that this shift happens. I don't have anything to do with the day-to-day operations of Cover Oregon. That's Clyde's job as the executive director. The board obviously makes the policy decisions about Cover Oregon. But once they made this policy decisions, then they needed somebody to make sure that that it happens. I have Sarah Miller as my project manager reporting to me. She's the deputy COO of the state. She has a deep background in IT projects and project management, and she will be dealing with that piece of it, the IT pieces of this. I see my job is really working with the five agencies that are involved, making sure that everybody understands what we're trying to achieve and that there's cooperation, and frankly, to work really, really closely with CMS on this. So, as I said, the goal here is that Oregonians can apply, shop, and choose a private plan online all in one sitting by November 15th when open enrollment starts. Open enrollment runs from November 15th of 2014 to February 15th of 2015. Those eligible for Medicaid will have a more streamlined process than they see right now, and we'll show a little bit about how that's expected to work. And this is really important, that Oregon retains control of the individual marketplace. We've created here a really healthy, competitive, low-cost, high-value marketplace in the individual health insurance market. And there's no interest in walking away from any of that. When we went to Washington, D.C., that was the plan we went with, was we want to move to use your technology, but we don't want to give up any of the authority or control that we have over our marketplace here. Again, the issue was really about our best shot at controlling costs and producing value is if we are locally involved in this market. So to accomplish that goal, as I've already said, we'll use the federal technology for QHP eligibility and enrollment, and we will build on the existing technology that is in Cover Oregon to determine Medicaid eligibility. The Cover Oregon's eligibility rules engine has been determining eligibility for Medicaid since January 1st. Now we just want to move it back over into OHA, into the Medicaid program. So the roadmap to November. When we went to Washington, D.C., as I said, we went with a really pretty clear plan of what we wanted to maintain control of and what we needed from them. The first thing was they have previously approved federal resources for 90-10 funding. It's Medicaid IT funding. They fund $9 for every dollar of local investment, really to incentivize states to build IT systems and to modernize their eligibility systems. They had previously approved resources for this work. What we went to them and asked for permission was to use those resources previously approved and previously funded by them to redirect them slightly to finance this project, because moving this IT system and the connection to the federal exchange has some financial consequences. So they were, what I have to say is CMS has been incredibly supportive. CMS has made it really clear they want us to be successful. They actually have also made it really clear that they believe in the original vision of Oregon to have an integrated eligibility system that's not just about Medicaid, but they also agree that it clearly can't be all done in all one bite, that it needs to be a sequenced, prioritized series of events, starting with the Medicaid program and making sure that Medicaid eligibility into the Medicaid program is efficient and works well. So what we came away with was the federal responsibility will be, as I said, QHP eligibility and enrollment. It's just the using their IT system to do that. They'll have call center functions for people who are determined eligible for QHPs, and that's the reason for that is they have all the data. They have the screen in front of them. They have all the data. A call center located here wouldn't have access to that data. They'll be responsible for the agent broker training and registration. Oregon keeps their responsibility for rate review. This wasn't actually even ever on the table, but I put it here because I want people to know that Oregon keeps its responsibility for rate review and the strong system that has been built here. We'll keep responsibility for front-end consumer outreach and education, for health plan management, and that's plan selection, that's going out and contracting for them, it's the quality metrics, it's all the necessary functions for good plan management will stay in Oregon. And then the Medicaid program, we operate the Medicaid program like we've always operated the Medicaid program. It's just now that the IT piece that was sitting over in Cover Oregon will be moved back into OHA, and that some interfaces will be built there. So the ongoing discussions with CMS is, you know, there are about 80,000 people who have already enrolled in health plans through Cover Oregon, on the commercial side in QHPs. The discussions we're having with them is how do we make they will need to re-enroll at the federal website in November. How do we make that easy? What kinds of tools can we bring to that to make that be the easiest experience possible? And what kind of approaches? Is it literally someone sitting down and having to re-enroll, or can we come up with some system to make that easier? Those discussions are just starting. CMS is open to talking about a lot of different ideas. When we come back in September before you, we should have a more detailed plan for what that might look like. And then there's some shared responsibility. They do have, the federal government has some monitoring responsibility. Most of this does reside with the state, but they do have some monitoring responsibility. And then how we interact with community partners and navigators. We're talking about how we keep those relationships here. We've built a really nice system of community partners that help get people enrolled, and we don't want to walk away from that. And they have expressed actually great interest in working with us on that. So this is the transition leadership. As I said, it was clear. A lesson we've all learned is that there does need to be clear accountability. This actually just shows the top layer. We have a whole project structure built underneath this that I'll give you the website where we're putting up all of our project materials. You'll be able to go out and see all of this. But I report directly to the governor. I have an advisory group that I will meet with, that I'm meeting with regularly. I'll start in a week, 2 weeks from now, made up of the heads of each of the departments that are involved in this. This touches five different agencies in some way, this project does. Again, as I said, I'm just responsible for this moving this technology going to the federal exchange. The piece that I want to point out is Alex Pettit, who is the state CIO, still has oversight over this project, and he has statutorily a direct line to the governor. He has a direct reporting line to the governor. So he will have that oversight role as well as being on my steering advisory committee. So we're using a three-pronged approach. The first is, I won't read all of this, but the first is the current work, the current ongoing work. It's 2014, we have Medicaid redeterminations, we have change of circumstances to be processed, the exchange is still the exchange, the Medicaid clients are still Medicaid clients, all that work still needs to be completed this year. But how we do that work and how we make it more efficient needs to work in such a way that it will be an easy fold over to when we get the IT moved over. So I want to make sure that's managed as part of this project. Then there's the 2015 QHP transition, that's making sure that the carriers can each connect to the federal exchange for enrollment in an efficient way, and the 2015 MAGI Medicaid project, which is the moving the eligibility engine out of Cover Oregon and over to OHA. So again, OHA will keep all of its responsibilities. It has a call center. It'll keep its call center. It does determinations, sends out notices. All of that stays in OHA. So the key components, again, I think some of these things are very different than how we've done some of this work before. First of all, we've co-located this staff. We have borrowed staff. Some people will be here for 2 weeks. Some people will be here for the full 6 months. They will be co-located. They're cross-agency teams. They'll be matched with people from the IT consultants so that we're all just focused on this. You're not distracted by other things. You sit with each other. You work through problems together and escalate appropriately. We'll have access to consulting, basically, from the agencies, from the operational resources in the agencies, so we can go and ask questions and get have cooperation from each of these agencies. We've made sure that everyone understands the importance of this project. Then we're going to have a single systems integrator. This was, again, a piece. We've learned how important the systems integrator is to this work, and we will have one for both of these projects, the same one for the QHP movement and the Medicaid movement. They're too interrelated to have a separate systems integrator. And then, obviously, the quality assurance contractor and the independent verification and validation contractor. The quality assurance contractor is Maximus. So this is just to show you what this will look like. I have to take the word probably out of this. And this is what this will look like. In November 15th, when November 15th rolls around, for QHP enrollment, people will be able to sit down. They click on apply now. They may land. They can do two things. There will be a local landing page, web page, where they'll have two choices and the language to direct them to the right choice. One is to OHP and one is to a QHP. We'll work on that language. There are good examples from other states to direct people to which one they should go to. If they go to the QHP, they'll be sent to healthcare.gov. It just connects directly to healthcare.gov, where their eligibility is determined through the federal portal. They immediately, once they're determined eligible, they get their tax credit amount, and then the plans that they have to choose from, the local Oregon plans, it's the local Oregon market, are shown to them. They can choose the plan there, and they're enrolled. So the goal here is one sitting. Healthcare.gov is a working website. We don't have to fix a website here. It is a working website. We just have to connect to it.
Can I ask a question, please?
Mm-hmm.
Is everyone who's currently enrolled in qualified health plans in Oregon now must re-enroll in the federal as of November 15th?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Kenny Geyer, yes, that's true. They do need to re-enroll. What we're examining is what approaches can we take to make that as easy as possible. We had hoped originally that we could just do a direct file transfer, but the data structure is very different, and there are issues around ID verification that only the individual can do. So it became pretty clear pretty early that, well, actually, like on day one for me, that was a road that we wouldn't be able to go down. So then it became, what kind of alternative things can we do? We've suggested that, you know, that if they could open the site a little bit earlier and allow Oregonians who have enrolled to go in and set up their account ID and get all that done, so they're not competing with the rest of the country on November 15th. They're willing to talk about it. They haven't said yes. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, because we're just talking about ideas right now. There's direct enrollment that carriers can do with the federal exchange. If that works, that would be great. So people who want to stay with the carrier they're with could do it directly through that carrier, which can be easier. I mean, we have to look into all of that. Again, when we come back in September, we'll have a better roadmap for that.
So in September, you'll be talking more about how you're going to do the outreach to people, whether insurance providers are doing that, or
all of that.
Oregon,
yeah.
And working with your community partners, still have a really clear business plan.
Yes, Representative Kevin Geyer, absolutely. So again, for the Medicaid program, it looks a little bit different. They would choose to click on the.
You know, what if they go to the QHP, but they're really Medicaid eligible?
So The way we have this set up for the first year, if they go to the federal site, but they're really Medicaid eligible, they will go ahead and determine eligibility on them and send us, because they have all of our rules in their system. We just sent all that to them at the beginning of last week. So they have all those rules. They will actually do the eligibility determination for people who accidentally show up there and are Medicaid eligible. And then send that to us, then we're responsible from that point on. It's any redeterminations we're completely responsible for. So once they're sent back, they are ours. But we had a choice to just have them do an assessment and send us the file and say, we think these people look like they're eligible, but only one state has figured out how to do that successfully, and we didn't want to introduce technology issues that would you know, broaden scope and potentially create problems for us. So for this first year, we're going to allow them, for those people who wander in there. We're going to do everything we can to direct people to our local website. But we know there will be people who show up at the OHP website and will be actually QHP eligible, and we'll have to do the same thing. In fact, one of the first things we're required to do in this project was set up what they call a bi-directional account transfer, so that when someone shows up for them and they do eligibility, they can send us that person. When someone shows up with us, we don't determine who's QHP eligible. We don't determine their eligibility, but we send the file back to them and say, this person is eligible for QHP. Contact them. They contact them and let them know they need to apply through them. So with the Medicaid enrollment, they'll click on that link. If this, you know, this is how it's envisioned right now, they will be presented with an application. They'll fill out the application. The eligibility rules engine will run and determine their eligibility. It then gets sent to our MMIS system for plan enrollment. They get enrolled in a plan there, and then the MMIS system sends out a packet that says it's a welcome packet. You've been found eligible. You know, you're in this plan, and you're covered. So it's not quite. There's still a mailing piece to this on the Medicaid side at this point. So the progress to date, we have our governance structure in place. As I said, we have I'm the single point of accountability. We have our cross-agency project team and roles identified. Sarah has got the project running incredibly well, with regular project updates every week. And we have project updates from the consultants. We have weekly or biweekly updates with CMS. There's a lot of accountability in this. The web page, we have established a web page, and this is the address for the web page where all project materials will be posted. Transparency on this project is really important to me. I want people to be able to go in and see the Maximus reports. I want people to be able to go in and see our consultants' weekly reports and updates to us. It's all going to be there. We have what we're calling a gap analysis in place. We cover Oregon, contracted with Deloitte to do a 45-day gap analysis. And what this does, at the end of the gap analysis, what we'll know is of what we have built now, of the technology that's been built, what can we use? What can be reused? For instance, the Medicaid eligibility rules engine. What other pieces can be reused and salvaged and saved? And then what do we still need to develop that will be the work over the months between now and November 20th? We know there will still be some development work that has to take place. We're moving a system. We're connecting to the federal exchange. So that's what we'll have at the end of that gap analysis. We'll know what can be used. We will know what needs to be built to finish this project. And then the state CIO will basically place a value on what it is that can be used. So we'll know what what the value is of what can be salvaged. So that work is due to be done on June 20th. There's an opportunity in the contract. Another important thing that we learned here is this is a deliverables-based contract. The vendor is at risk. There is a holdback provision in the contract so that if they don't deliver an approved product, we can hold back payment. So we have tried to institute what we think are best practices in this. So the sign-off on this is due to be done no later than June 30th. What we have done also at the same time, we need to, again, the time frames here are pretty tight. So we have posted for a system integrator to do this work. We've done the scope of work. We've posted the notice, what we're doing to try to make sure we have qualified candidates is that what we got from CMS was the list of there are 10 firms nationally who have successfully served as system integrators on state-based exchanges that have connected to the federal exchange. So that's what we're doing is a special procurement that says these 10 firms have a record of success. Tell us, you know, give us a proposal. So that the RFP to complete that technology transition is also we're aiming for the June 30th date.
There's a question related to this.
Yes, go ahead.
Could I just ask about one of the things that came up in the first data report was not having enough money was one of the reasons that Carolyn Lawson used for not hiring a system integrator.
Mm-hmm.
How are you approaching this RFP?
So what we'll do, it's scope. We have the resources that have been previously approved that we will apply to this. If what we'll do is negotiate around scope. If you can't get us all the way to a fully automated, and I actually don't think this is a fully automated Medicaid system, I'm less worried about the QHP side because that's the carriers connecting to an already working website. The Medicaid program, if we can't get to the full automated end-to-end, then, you know, how far can we get for the available funds? So we'll be managing scope like you would manage any contract.
And envisioning scope, are you still including the DHS, TANF, SNAP, ERDC, or you've already...
So that has already been put out of scope for this project. That those, again, it's a vision that we all still believe in and want to achieve over time, but what we have learned here is that we need to sequence these things. So the first necessary element for any of that is a successful Medicaid eligibility program. So we want to get that done and get that work completed and then move on to the next steps. We haven't walked away from the vision. It's just it needs to be done in sequentially.
You're about to wrap up.
I need to hand off to. So this is the milestones at a very high level. Obviously, this is only three dates on this. June 30 is the gaps analysis. By our state CIO insists that there are at least 90 days of testing in this process. So August, it's really mid-August. It says August 15th here. It's really mid-August until we have the system integrator contract in place. We won't have a more precise date. But that allows us to have the full 90 days of testing so we know everything works when we get to November 15th. So...
Thank you, Tina.
Could I just ask a question about that? So, and I appreciate those dates and the milestones, but the problem, I mean, under the best of contentions, so I need to understand what happens if we don't meet the milestone, because again, this is very limited, the time here. There's a lot of people that are concerned about what's going to happen come November 15th. So I just need to understand, so what's the backstop if it doesn't work perfectly, if we don't meet the milestone? So where's the room in there to make this system work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. When they started Cover Oregon last year, they didn't have a plan. And it was December before they figured out they needed to start putting together Plan B. And that's when they developed this hybrid system, which uses the technology that had been built, plus a large number of people that have been reassigned, some from OHA, a lot from Cover Oregon, and some temporary staff to be able to start processing these applications. They've gotten more efficient as they've learned, and we looked at some of the times that it took to complete an application they started. to what they're doing now. It's a third of the time. Also in that time, we made some improvements into the technology, so that's made it work. That system will stay in place through all of 2014 because we are still responsible at Cover Oregon for the QHP applicants, and we're still responsible to process the Medicare redeterminations until the Medicare system does
Medicaid,
it themselves,
yeah.
Medicaid systems. So there's a backup place. It works. It's proven. It's there. So even if the Fed system doesn't work for some reason, we will still be able to process applications.
You're done. You have something to finish?
Yes.
Okay, well, then we're open for questions. Is that right?
I still have a little bit.
Okay, well, why don't you finish and then we'll open
for questions.
We only have about 12 minutes right now.
Okay.
We had three basic tasks. One is to control the technology. Two is increase the efficiency of operations, which I just talked about. And three is to stabilize the business and the financial situation. So part of my part now is to talk about the business and financial restructuring. Costs were running, if we had continued at the April burn rate, we would have been out of money in August. So we had to start controlling cash. We put in a cash flow budgeting process, and I monitor that carefully. We look at how people are doing the budget and put in controls about who can sign contracts. It was fairly open when we got there. Now the only one that can sign a contract is the executive director. Some large invoices were being approved on kind of a lot of people could approve invoices. Any invoice that's over $10,000 has to be approved by myself, the COO, or the CIO. We just got to have control of this stuff. And then that way we can start monitoring budget. Are these really in the budget? Are we being careful where the money goes? We reviewed a lot of contracts and said, we probably don't need these contracts. They'd be nice, but we've got to terminate them, or we've got to downsize them. So we've done a lot of that. We just downsized one technology contract from about $400,000 to $75,000. All these things. And then we also have done some restructuring and looking to figure out how to make staff more efficient. Then we had some business operation problems. We were not doing a very good job of paying the agents. When the first board meeting I attended to in April, one of the agents complained because he'd done a lot of work and hadn't been paid yet. We started looking at that. We put four people just focusing on that with addition to the other people who were working there. There's a lot of complexities between two pieces of software that weren't talking to each other very well, so we couldn't verify some of the data as in one piece of software and transfer that over to the business side that would produce the invoices and do the accounting for the commissions. That's been improved. As of May 19th, 78% of the commissions owed people have been paid. By the end of June, we'll be up to an 85% rate, and by the end of July, our systems will be to where everybody's getting paid on a timely basis. We also need to put in a billing system. We talked about that monthly fee for administrative services. We haven't even billed anybody for that yet. And that money, we should start collecting that in January. It'll be June before we have that system up, but we'll end up billing the insurance companies for the administrative fees through June, and then we'll be timely each month after that. That should produce somewhere around $5 to $6 million of revenue for Cover Oregon this year. And then we need to do a good job on communications. And Tina's talked a lot about that with CMS. We're in meetings with them, regular scheduled meetings with their team. They have an Oregon team that meets with our Oregon team. We're spending more time with insurance agents, dealing with some of the concerns they had about payment. We're spending time with carriers. We've been spending time with the tribal group. And we like to meet with employees and tell them what's going on. So we have at least every 2 weeks we have an all-employee meeting.
Please include us on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. This is the total funds expended through by Cover Oregon. It doesn't have any OHA funds in here, but through Cover Oregon since its inception through April. You can see it's $195 million. 63% of that was for IT development. There's another 6% of it there's for computers and servers. And the balance of it's general administrative, occupancy, communications, advertising, and so forth. But remember that 66%, that's about $120 million. I want to come back to that in a minute. Now, the next slide is the sources and uses of funds for 2012. I broke it out into the first half of the year. Excuse me, 2014. I broke it out into the first half of the year and the second half of the year. The first half of the year is the 4 months actual through April, and then we've estimated June and July. And the last half, of course, is just estimate. And you can see in the first 6 months, we were spending about $11 million a month. The last 6 months were projected to reduce that to somewhere around $5 million a month. At the end of the year, based on our revenues, we should have about $1,800,000 left over to carry over into 2015. That's not very much, but that's about the best we can do at this point. I want to talk a little bit about 2015, and I think there's the board of directors of Cover Oregon are the ones that make policy decisions and recommendations to the legislature if there's going to be any recommendations about changes. But as we go through this, we need to make some estimates for the board to understand. One is how many people are going to be insured next year through Cover Oregon. That number affects the revenue. It also determines how much services we have to provide and how much outreach and how much we have to spend on those services if we're going to be self-sufficient. I think we need to be hard-nosed about that data. We need to not wish for it. We need to come up with numbers we think we can really achieve. So we have a lot of things to find out, but these three guiding principles are going to be: one is OHA needs to take care of Medicaid processing. It's going to have about 1.2 million applications and redeterminations a year. Even under the best of circumstances, Cover Oregon couldn't exceed 300,000. So that's 4 to 5 to 6 times as many applications to process. A lot of the same rules. They have more IT people. I mean, that's a couple billion, I don't know, several billion a year in expenses over there. And that's a big job. Technology is a big cost to the state, and that's where that belongs. The second point is, and the Medicaid IT needs to be finished. You just can't continue to operate this from a state basis without it. And the third is Oregon needs to remain a state-based marketing company, SBM. And because it's time, I'm going to go over to, let's go to the slide here on the importance of completing the technology slide. Yeah. Two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We started, I like to measure the basic units of what our business is, whatever the business is, whether you're processing apples so much a pound, whether you're processing applications so much an application. We started looking at the direct cost that it takes to process our applications with our system now, the hybrid system. If we took just that direct cost, someone that's given an application, they put it in the computer, they figure out how to get in there, they get someone signed up or they get them re-verified, that's what we call direct labor, and they're the ones who do it. It's not supervision, it's not cleaning the janitorial services, any of that. We started measuring that, and for 2014 and 15, we believe that cost would exceed $120 million. So you say, well, why are we spending $160 million in software? This is the reason. You pay for it pretty quickly. If you have to pay people to do what computers can do, and you're processing over 1 million applications or 1 million redeterminations a year, you need the technology. The hybrid process we put in place has reduced that cost, direct cost I'm talking about, to about $30 million. So even though we kick about the cost of technology and not working and we use this manual application, there's still a significant amount of work and money that software has saved the company, has saved the state. If it were fully automated, it would be less than $1 million to process all these applications. It'd just be someone putting the stuff into the keyboard and that's it. Now, when I use these numbers, I don't want to confuse anybody. These aren't the people talking on the phone that you still need to do. These aren't the people that are working with someone that's blind and needs some assistance. These aren't all the other indirect costs. It's just direct, but it gives you a flavor of why that technology is so important. There's a lot of other indirect savings that go with it. So that's why this project that Tina was just describing, I think, is so important to the state. The last thing on the importance of the SBM status, it allows Oregon to manage its market. The CMS designation is what's called conditional SBM. We're the first state that has been allowed to use the technology, and they've said that they won't charge us for it. The state is able to continue to retain the administrative fee. Now, if you're FFM state, the federal government charges 3.5%. Our fee is about 2.5%, so maybe 2.8 or 9%. So our fee is less than what someone would pay if they paid for the same insurance rate from another state. So that's an important thing to remember. It's a big advantage for us to remain an SBM, both for the people in Oregon and for the people who are trying to manage health care costs. That kind of concludes my my report in a summarized way, sir.
Good, thank you. We have time for a couple of questions at least. Representative Conger, you were in the middle. You want to go on where you were?
I was in the middle of asking about how you arrived at the fee, and relatedly, what percent of the average premium cost is the fee?
I wasn't involved in arriving at the fee, so I can't answer that. I can try to find out and get back to you on how it was arrived at. But I think it's somewhere around 2.5% of the cost of the insurance is what the fee amounts to.
That's an average across the whole population.
Oregon.
The population that's insured through Cover
yes.
Oregon.
Yes, and I want to say we haven't done a detailed analysis of that. I just asked people to give me an estimate of it, and it came in at that number because I wanted to compare it to the Fed rate when we were talking about what the Fed charges, and I saw, well, it's lower. And what did that mean when we went back to Washington? And that's part of why we negotiated to remain an SBM state instead of an FFM state.
I'm confused by the acronyms, but it's not relevant to my question,
okay.
So we'll move on. 2.5% and the...
It's an important question, though. The acronym is that we manage the marketplace rather than turning the whole thing over to the federally managed marketplace.
That's right.
That's the two options.
What I'm trying to get at is, what are the people who are purchasing insurance, what are they getting for that cost? And I have two other really, I think, fundamental questions that I want to get to, if I can.
Because we're out of time.
Okay. Just skip that. They're paying 2.5% and should be happy to get it. Demographics, 75% of the population that's insured so far is above 35 years old. The young and healthy population does not appear to be rushing to come in and purchase individual plans through Cover Oregon. Is that a demographic disaster, and does it mean that the premiums will grow rapidly now or in the near future?
I'm not someone to answer that question for you. In it, I don't have the data to know that.
It's in your slideshow. I mean,
I have
the age data is in your slideshow.
QHP, I have that, but I don't know how it is. I know it's a little lower than other states, but Medicaid's higher. I don't know the balance there. I think that's a complex question. It's a fair question. I think it deserves an answer, but I can't give it to you today.
Okay, last question. I'll make this quick. I actually have a boatload of questions, but because our time is limited, very quickly, your projection, and I understand, you know, when I say your projection, I get that you walked into this mess, and you're trying to present realistic numbers. You've got less than $2 million at the end of the year. In the second half of the year, your average burn is $5 million a month, or just under $5 million a month. Let's call it $4 million and change. So you've got less than 2 weeks of cushion there. And according to the math that I did quickly on the back of the napkin, and I think you confirmed in your testimony, your expected revenue from the administrative fee is around $5 to $6 million bucks a year. So as I look at it, again, second half of the year, so I'm just assuming that it will kind of stay the same, you're spending $6.8 million on compensation. Where's the rest of the money going to come from?
Well, actually, it won't stay the same because if you look at the details of that number, half of it, a little over half of it is licensing for IT, a couple of IT people to keep it going. And
well, I was in your salary and benefits line. I'm only talking $6.8 million is,
oh, you're talking
is
6 about
months of salary and benefits.
Excuse me, I misunderstood. Okay, I was talking about the monthly fee. But back to your question. When we go over to the FFM and we transfer the technology engines to QHA, that budget next year will be half of what you're talking about here if we kept everything else the same.
So
the second point of it is on the line
of money
there,
in
the
like
budget,
2 months.
You see a TBA. There is some readjustment that goes on between Oregon Health Authority for some of the taking care of the Medicaid applications this year. And there'll be some additional carryover there yet to be worked out because it's a combination between CMS looking at our budgets and the grants and how we allocate that. We have to provide that information. We'll have that in September. I'm very sensitive about when you do a budget, your revenues have to match your expenses. And we know that's got to be taken care of.
I'm going to suggest
a $6 million budget.
Yeah, it's small compared to what it was.
All right. One quick question. I'm going to suggest a process that we send you questions by email, and you answer and copy the whole committee. That would be very helpful for us to get rid of this.
Can I direct them to Sandy? Because I have a bunch of questions, too. Can we just direct them to Sandy? And
well, you I'll can. Do it on one? No, you can do it that way. You can do it, Sandy.
I'm just
you can do your
so
own.
I'll replicate.
Well, that's the point. Sense. So yeah. I would hope it would copy all of us so we know. Representative Wyder, do you want to have a quick one?
Real quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you talked about putting a business plan together, and we've seen a business plan before. I was very adamant and knew it wasn't going to work. We're now facing 5% declining revenue from the federal or from the match. 2019, we're going to lose another 5%. I would like to see a business plan where this pencils out so we can be honest with the Oregon taxpayers so they know what this is going to cost them. Right now we have 80% of the people that we're subsidizing and only 20% are full pay, it looks like, they're enrolling into this. Where are their insurance premiums going to be? I'm getting complaints where I have people in my district watch their insurance that they were paying $600 a month for go to $900 a month. We need these numbers, and we need to be honest with people so they know what they're going to be paying for their health insurance for subsidizing everybody else that's coming into this program. So whether it's going to be doubling and tripling tax rates on the Oregon taxpayer to pay for this, but if you could work that up for us, that would be great as well when you're putting your business plan together for this. And I'd like to know when you're thinking this would be done.
It's like those subsidies are federal subsidies. They're not.
But they're declining federal subsidies that we have to pick up the match on, Chair Greenlick.
Not in the near term, we're not.
2015 is when, I mean, I gave the floor speech on it, have it right here, out of our own numbers that we have from the Oregon Health Authority, where they're going down. 2015, we lose 5% of that match. We go from 100% to 95%. 2019, we go to 90%.
Is that an OHP match you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This isn't OHP we're talking about.
So, but it falls into...
the private health plan.
It's going to fall into these subsidizing those plans through this.
Let's have that conversation on a different day.
Okay.
But we do need your projected membership for 2015.
Yes, and I need to pull this stuff together and go to the board. The board needs to discuss what they think we need to do, and I would think we'd be able to bring that back to you by September.
Well, I would say the faster you can bring that back to us, to all of us, the better it is. I would hope you don't wait till September. We really need to know what's going on. I think the questions Representative Wyder is asking, the questions Representative. It'd also be helpful if you would send us a message to all of us about the question of who subsidizes what and what's being subsidized with it. I think there's a great deal of confusion about that, and it would be very useful if you on if you let us know. So the more you can feed us on an ongoing basis, that's why put us on that list. Mm-hmm. And I would ask whatever you submit to the board that's public information, please send to our committee. And I guess the vice chair is correct. It would probably be better to filter everything through the administrator so we all know what's going on and you're not bombarded by a bunch of
things. That would make it easier for us if we got it one source and then we
can... But please keep us informed at least on a monthly basis between now and then. Okay. Let's not wait till September. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're doing God's work on this. We'll close the public hearing on Pepper, Oregon, and open the public hearing on OHP, particularly with reference to how things are going in the CCOs.
Oh, OHA.
I'm sorry, OHA. Okay. I get confused, too, with the...
While we're transitioning panels, could I ask that maybe at the next interim days, we have the carriers come up and talk about their interface with
great.
Us? Because I would be really curious to see how it's...
My understanding of is the 11 of the 15 carriers already have the links to the federal plan. So there are only four of them.
And maybe one or two community partners.
Yeah.
What their interfaces
are. Make some suggestions about what we...
Okay.
Would be great. Okay. We're going to talk about CCOs.
Yeah.
You know we have some questions behind them already. That isn't on the agenda, but how about if you start and let us know how things are going? And we'll try and ask you to make up the time, so we'll hope this segment ends by 4 o'clock. So we have three more agenda items after that. Go for it.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record. I'm Suzanne Hoffman, and I'm the interim director for the Oregon Health Authority.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I think.
Good luck.
Been in this role for a couple of weeks, and before that, I was the chief operating officer of the agency. And with me today is Leslie Clement, our chief of policy, who's been working.
Did you say chief apologist?
Only if necessary. Chief of policy, and she has been working at a detailed level with this work. So between the two of us, we'll provide you some information, hopefully be able to answer your questions, and move on to some representatives from CCOs to talk directly with. So just to give you a few updates on data, through April of 2014, approximately since January 1 and through April, more than 302,000 Oregonians gained coverage through the Oregon Health Plan, bringing the Oregon Health Plan total enrollment to approximately 935,000 individuals. About 90% of those are in one of 16 coordinated care organizations, or CCOs. And there will be some metrics available, a full data for a calendar year 2013 will be available in late June, so we'll be looking forward to providing you with that and making that available. Some of the early results are exactly what we, going in the direction we want to see, in that emergency department utilization down 13% since 2011, hospital readmissions down 8%, reduced hospital admissions for congestive heart failure, COPD, and adult asthma, and CCO primary care visits have gone up 16%, which is good. That's the type of care that we want people to get first. And patient-centered primary care home enrollment has increased 51% since 2012. Again, I don't think I need to remind this committee, but the coordinated care model isn't just another version of managed care. It really is a new model of care, and it does involve using best practices. There are learning collaboratives that the CCOs participate in. It's about sharing responsibility for the health of Oregonians, about measuring performance, and most importantly, measuring health outcomes and not just medical visits. It's about providing information for transparency, which we continue to build and work on, and really about a sustainable rate of growth. Some of the next steps in the coming months have to do with expanding that coordinated care model beyond just the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid population to PEB, Public Employees Benefit Board. So those folks that are state employees would have the benefit of higher quality coordinated care that could hold costs down. And the newly awarded contracts for 2015 with health plans have this model embedded. For OEB, that's the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, existing health plans recently renewed their contracts to include coordinated care elements. And there'll be an RFP in fall of 2015 that will require those coordinated care elements for new plans beginning in October 2016. And then finally, the Oregon Insurance Division has an initial set of new metrics and measurement standards to promote market-wide transparency and alignment for 2015, and carriers will include metrics with their rate filings for informational purposes. So that's just a really quick, high-level sort of reminder overview of where we are with some very early results. Kept it very high level so that you'd have time for questions, and knowing that you have a full agenda today, we'll leave it to you.
Great. Your presentation.
Are you just here for questions?
No, she's gonna
we have some CCOs that are going to talk to us about what's going on.
We got some questions.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Are we going to have something on mental health integration?
Yes, that's one of the questions we've asked them to talk
okay.
about.
Okay, yeah.
We can go right to the presentations if the committee would like to do that. What we've done is we've invited Family Care to kind of present from a more experienced health plan that's been around for a while in an urban setting, and we've invited Yamhill, CCO, that was just brand new and presents from a more rural perspective. And so they're here and can...
About the general issue or about mental health integration?
Mental health integration.
Okay, well, let's...
Are they coming back?
Pardon me?
Are they coming back after the CCO's talk?
Well, there are at least two questions. There are three questions. One is, we wanted to know how basically you were in getting the 350,000 new people into care was the number one question. The number two question was, how's the mental health implementation going, the integration going? The number three question had to do with, how are we doing in terms of the direct entry midwives and their relationship to this program? And if we have time for those, there'll be a fourth one. So
a fourth or fifth.
A fourth or fifth one. But yeah, however you'd like to manage that.
So do you want to talk about
capacity? Yeah, we can talk a little bit about the enrollment. There's a whole lot of different ways to attack the enrollment. Administratively, there have been challenges with the enrollment. We knew that from the get-go, and what we've tried to do is really work closely with the CCOs to identify early adjustments that we need to make, getting individuals in the right category. And we have continued to have that routine collaboration, weekly calls that apprise the CCOs where we're at, in addition to more in-depth meetings on a monthly basis. With respect to capacity, I think the good news is for most of the state, we have the capacity, and I think we're in better shape than many states are. There are a couple areas that are struggling with respect to capacity. Trillium CCO is one of them that has had to close part of their network, and in Southern Oregon, Cascade CCO has had to close part of their network. What that means is that they do two things. It's not a closed door entirely, but they provide for escalation for kids, for pregnant women, for high medical needs, and provide for opportunities if someone had been on the plan before and may have had an existing relationship with a practice to provide for enrollment in those cases. The other thing that happens in some cases is that those individuals will go into a fee-for-service or an open card on a temporary basis until the plan is able to meet the demand and open up the CCO again. But across the state, I think really the news is good. One of the areas that we've heard was a high request, and probably not surprisingly, is the dental care. So there was a pent-up demand, and the dental offices were really filled up. I have not heard of cases where they haven't been able to see them. They may have had to wait a little longer, but for the most part, that has been a really good experience. We monitor provider capacity, CCO capacity, on a regular basis, look at it by county level, look at when a plan is getting to 120%, that's the lever that actually closes the CCO at that point and flips them to an open card. So is there any questions?
Representative Thompson always asks the question, I'll save him asking it. Are you able to get these people to the primary care physicians when they need care? Yes, I beat you to it.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a really great question. This February data showed significant progress, I think, when the numbers are finalized at the end of June, we're going to see a significant increase in the number of CCOs that have implemented a high level of the primary care homes, the highest tier. That provides for team-based care, which is the only, we have to do things differently. So we can't just, I mean, that's what this transformation process is about. We wouldn't have the capacity that we have today if we weren't doing things differently. So team-based care, telehealth, you know, just different ways of accessing, not always by physician appointments. And then, you know, trying to incentivize care in different ways so that it's not always that face-to-face physician visit. So.
Remember, in February, you didn't have 350,000 new people.
No.
I have a question.
Yes.
Just for clarification.
Yeah.
They kind of shut down at 120%. That's 120% of what?
100%. So we work with each of the plans to identify what their capacity is. They identify that. When they exceed that by 120%, you know, if they get 120% of their defined capacity, then their CCO plan is closed.
So you're talking about like a medical home provider.
I'm talking about
plan.
I'm talking about the
whole
CCO in that particular area.
So 120 when they have network adequacy to cover 100 people, and when they get to 120, they shut down.
That's
something
right.
Like that.
And two of them have shut down so far.
Yeah, and then you do a fee for service, so people that might be outside of their network can get reimbursed. That's
right.
What you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
And are you keeping, are you tracking how many people, for instance, are accessing primary dental care? What percentage of people, you know, I've heard that that's covered both in the qualified health plans and in OHP, that people are entitled to it. We're providing funds for that in a global budget, and there's not a lot of outreach and perhaps not as many people making use of it as could be. Are you tracking that? And the same question for prenatal care. It's been a big challenge of how do we get more people to be seen in the first 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. So are you able to keep up with that kind of tracking?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so we are tracking 33 specific quality metrics, and then 17 are identified as a kind of an incentive payment. Prenatal is one of those. Mm-hmm. We're working really closely with the CCOs, and I think we're looking at claims information, but we're also working with them that when that claims lag or if the data isn't there, if they can demonstrate the documentation outside of that, we're accepting that. So yes, we are tracking that information. And then anything that actually comes in on a claim,
we have that data in our running reports, and we do that in a number of different ways, but we actually, working with our Oregon Health Policy Board, our Office of Health Analytics has begun using a health system dashboard that tracks healthcare utilization, it tracks costs, and it tracks quality. It's an iterative dashboard, and so, you know, we introduced the board to the first iteration. It had some Medicare Advantage data in that, as well as some commercial, and as we accumulate more data, we're able to make that reflective of all healthcare costs throughout the state by all payers is the ultimate goal. So,
and Medicare Advantage doesn't have a lot of prenatal care.
I'm sorry.
I say Medicare Advantage doesn't have a lot of
no,
prenatal
don't.
Care.
It
won't be.
No,
and some don't. Big
issue.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, among the CCOs, the two CCOs that are having some capacity issues at this point, they are actively creating strategies to make progress there, including, and I think, prioritizing children, pregnant women, people with serious conditions that need help right away, and people they already have established relationships with, so, and we'll keep working with them on that. I want to acknowledge something you said about the number of people that came in the door all at once, even faster than we might have expected. So there have been administrative challenges, and the CCOs, in spite of that, are doing amazing work and working really hard to meet those challenges. And it's really OHA's number one priority to make sure that we are prepared to be good partners and support them in this. So that's what we'll continue to work on in these coming months.
Thank you. Representative Conger.
I just actually was following up on the question about access. You said two of the CCOs are having problems keeping their network and assigning people to providers. What about the other ones? Maybe you could elaborate a little bit. Are you hearing anything about, like, you know, we're kind of stretched to capacity from providers or from the CCOs other than the two that you've already described?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it really varies across the state, and we do look at it at the county level. And so what you will see in many cases is you'll see a very, very close level of, you know, space between what their capacity is and how many they have. There's not too many red marks. It's not. There's no significant areas of concern. Pacific Source and the Columbia Gorge is starting to see some challenges. So, again, it really depends on where you are in the state in terms of, you know, finding the or having the ability to make those assignments to providers.
The reason for the question is, you know, ultimately it's not the CCOs who are providing the care.
Right.
Right. They have to hook up with providers who are willing to, and not just willing, but have the ability to see more patients. And I really have no idea. I'm sure there are regional variations, even local variations, you know, city to city in how much capacity there is, and also in how many providers are willing to accept more Medicaid patients. What I'm wondering is, ultimately, are we going to bump up against a wall here where we won't have any providers? And I guess relatedly, and then I'll stop, are there a lot more people we're anticipating who are going to sign up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think what we have been surprised by is how many people have come in so quickly. And so we don't anticipate that there are a significant number of people still out there that are qualified for OHP and that are not already on. Now, until
your estimates were, as I remember correctly, you were getting to about 780,000 by the end of 2015. I think that's the number, and you're now at 950,000 in 2014.
Yeah.
So we have experienced numbers way beyond our initial projections. I think frankly the good news is it is good to have them come in sooner. We do benefit from 100% federal match. If we can continue to see the reform in our delivery system during these first 3 years and get patients established with providers and continue to encourage the quality, I think that we sit in a very good situation. There are primary care shortages throughout the country. We've been looking at this through our workforce committee, and we continue to monitor that. I think we will continue to be pressed to look at how to deliver care differently, and that really is moving away from the old office visit. We're going to have to do that, and in rural areas, we're going to have to use telehealth.
I understand you're going to have to continue to change the model a little bit. I would just encourage you to look for signals of stress, like long wait times to see a doctor. So I don't know if you do.
Physician suicide rates.
But that too. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do monitor the access. We have to because of federal Medicaid requirements. We monitor complaints. We monitor grievances. Right now, the number of complaints coming in from our fee-for-service individuals regarding access issues is just 3% of the total. So it's, you know, again, it's not to say that there aren't issues and aren't problems, but right now they seem to be manageable. But we've got reports, and we've got we're looking at it all the time.
Okay, and then let's go after this question. Let's go to the mental health issue, but don't go away. We'll be back with some more. Representative Wyden.
This kind of goes on whereas with Cover Oregon, because we're losing 5% of that match, right? We have to come up with 5%. And has that been factored in? Have you looked into that? And are we looking at solutions like where we'll let the CCOs maybe charge a $10 copay if someone goes to the emergency room to make sure they go to the primary cares, some things like that to help overcome that burden and stress of the cost of the health care? And then where are we going to subsidize that 5% from? Is it going to be on health insurance premiums from people that are paying? Or are we going to be picking those funds up from someplace else? I'm sure this has went through your mind, and you might have an answer for me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that we're going to have to continue to look at multiple strategies. I mean, it's always good to incentivize the right care, but we also have to disincentivize people accessing services at the wrong time with higher costs. I think when the decision was made to expand Medicaid here in Oregon, there was a report done by Shattuck that showed that there were cost-benefit analysis that showed that, in fact, some of these individuals that are now covered by Medicaid were previously receiving services paid by state general funds, and so there was an offset there. I do think that overall in the savings, and it would be interesting to invite some of the hospitals in to hear what they're seeing in terms of their uncompensated care, those that are coming into their doors as having coverage instead of being uninsured. So I think we're just going to have to monitor this going forward. But at the outset, I think the decision to do this was based on a cost-benefit analysis that showed that covered individuals are cheaper for the state than continuing to pay uninsured.
If I may follow up, because these are things we need to look at, because 2015, we're losing 5%.
Right.
2019, it's another 10% that's gone. That's a lot of money.
Not another 10%.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another 5%. 10%. It'll be 10% total at that, and then after that, there's no guarantee.
But in the meantime, we're getting $1 billion a year to pay for care that somebody else was paying for all along inside the state.
My dad this week.
But
you're right, it's a budgeting issue.
And someone's going to have to pay the tab, and I don't ever hear anybody coming up looking for ways. And, I mean, just implementing a little copay, because right now they can walk in and get free glasses one after another and go back every day and get them with no penalty on some of this stuff. So
let's move to the mental health issue. We got to the next panel.
So Jeff Hetherington is here, and Silas and Jim Carlisle from the NLA.
Let's do it.
Make it up here.
Oh, yeah, I can. Boy, buddy.
You may want to help Representative Widener, your representative. Get a sense of what's happening in Yamhill County in terms of the costs.
Yep. Well, I talked to Silas, so. And he's doing an awesome job in Yamhill County.
Okay. Thank you. Introduce yourself and go forth and talk about mental health integration.
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon, Chairman and Committee. For the record, my name is Jim Carlo. I'm the Chief Executive with Yamhill CCO. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about the coordinated care in the Yamhill County service area. Before we share with you some of our important milestones in some of our transformation efforts, it's important for us to recognize both the origin of our community and the organization that we developed. I think Leslie mentioned that there were many coordinated care organizations that started from traditional mental health or physical health plans with relationships with other sectors. In Yamhill County, we actually started a brand new organization from scratch. So in September 2011, a local stakeholder group gathered in McMinnville in response to the House and Senate bills around coordinated care. In these meetings of stakeholders, we had representation from most of the sectors, the hospitals, the mental health, the public health, and the physicians, as well as the county commissioners and some of the other statutorily required components of that organization. The goal for us was to determine the community's intent and desire and their appetite to support an existing managed care infrastructure, or to intentionally break down some silos and start from scratch as we did. Which also came with that decision, intentional responsibility to embrace the managed care model in the community and some of the risk that the community had been previously adverse to. In August 2012, we formally organized a board of directors. We filed for corporate status as a 501c3 and submitted our application to the Oregon Health Authority to become one of the last CCOs, last of the 16, that is. For the first time, our community was engaged and engaged in a model where they started to felt some ownership around the care coordination. Prior to coordinated care organizations, we had about 40% managed care penetration in our community. 60% were enrolled in the fee-for-service model that Leslie spoke of. For us, this was a tremendous accomplishment. And just one of many that we were committed to. Today we have nearly 25,000 members enrolled in our CCO, which also represents a 38% growth since the Affordable Care Act.
Sorry, I missed that number. What's your membership?
About 25,000. And that includes a 38% growth from the Affordable Care Act policy change in January, so the expansion population. Today we've met greater than 80% of our quality performance metrics as established by the CCO, and we share that with one other CCO in the state currently, and that's family care.
They brought the stars along today.
Pardon?
I say they brought the stars along for us
today. Well, we're doing our best. So we've also begun multiple transformation projects that focus on lifestyle and behavior choices for our members. We've included in our handout that I think you have a copy of a list of some of those projects. Most of them are focused on behavioral health projects that are currently underway, and I'll let Silas speak to a few of those.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Silas Hallerensteiner. I am the Yamhill CCO board chair, and I also serve as the Yamhill County Health and Human Services director, and am responsible for both public health and publicly funded behavioral health care within Yamhill County. As Jim has mentioned, we've been doing a lot of transformation at the local level, and pretty much the best thing about our effort has been the ownership that the community has taken locally. And I think it is really accurate to reflect it as a grassroots approach to transforming the care in our community. And that really involves strong leadership from community advisory council and advocates and family members who are either on the plan or have family members and loved ones that they care for that are served through the Yamhill CCO, and really a strong group of providers that take a lot of ownership over the clinical advisory panel and setting some of the pathways that we're trying to improve forward as we work at the board level to support essentially the community and the clinical work that we're needing to pay for as we transform a local delivery system. Speaking directly to the behavioral health projects that we're working at, I do have a letter, and I want to make sure that people do have a copy of that, because then I'll know how closely I need to read. Okay, perfect. But for the rest of the public participants in the meeting today, I'd like to at least briefly touch on them. We've made some great strides with Newburgh opening up a new federally qualified health center just a couple months ago in March that created access for another 2,500 members, and we've been fortunate to be able to co-locate, initially co-locate, not fully integrate, but to co-locate with public health and behavioral health and women, infant, and children's services, primary care, and dental care. So we now have a unified location for health and wellness where members can be served in Newburgh.
Can I check the language? When you talk about behavioral health, are you including traditional mental health services?
Yes. Okay. And I'm including alcohol. Yes, Mr. Chair. Treatment. Alcohol and drug and mental health services for children, adolescents, and adults within that site in Newburgh. So much like some of the efforts across the state that sometimes get referenced, the Gladstone Project in East Gresham area, East Portland, where they're able to say, look, we know that for some of our members, having a location where there's integrated care and you can access services without having to pack your three kids into a car and travel to three different points across the community creates a better opportunity for some shared savings and some integration and for partnerships to be formed at the local level. So we're doing that in Newburgh, and we're doing that in McMinnville, bringing primary care into a specialty behavioral health center that provides alcohol and drug and mental health services for adults and developmental disability services for members that we're currently serving. So that's a partnership with our large federal qualified health center, Virginia Garcia. We are also putting behaviorists into primary care so that patient-centered primary care homes are able to respond to mild, moderate behavioral health needs and to really coach people through lifestyle behavior changes that are necessary to manage their chronic illness and to really target some of the issues that are causing them to not fully be successful with care plans. And we're having really good success early with that. And across the state, many CCOs are doing this, so this is not unique work, but it's really important for us to have that in order to keep folks from needing higher level, higher cost service and to improve their quality of life. We have really worked hard recently to expand two new existing transition treatment recovery support services that we have historically provided for women and children that are in the child welfare system. So they have an initial abuse neglect finding, and what we've done is provide a support, safe, clean, and sober supportive environment for them and their kids while they're in intensive treatment, and it keeps the family from being separated and or allows for reunification in some circumstances when a mom is working hard to be reunified and to follow a lifestyle that's pro-social and clean and sober and actually parenting her children. And what we're doing is taking a 5-bed program and expanding to 15, where we'll have 3 5-bed programs, and we'll actually have a dad's program that's focused on men And in addition to that, we have an intake family stabilization program that we're starting that's a short-term intensive evaluation period for 0 to 30 days where if a child is about to be placed in foster care, we'll provide 24/7 supervision support on-site, make sure there's professional services supports that the mom or the dad is going to hear about the court proceeding and know what kind of legal requirements they're expected to follow, at the same time that we really focus on the identified client, which is the child or children. So it's really taking a different approach to thinking about adverse childhood events and minimizing early trauma because we know there's a lot of health indicators that are linked to that, and I'll touch on that later. We also have certified recovery mentors.
Much later, I hope. I say not too much later.
We have certified, yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move it along. We have certified recovery mentors also for alcohol and drug services as well as peer wellness coaches. So we're really investing in peer delivered services and wraparound so that individuals are learning and being supported from other people who have lived experience. And part of that is a flexible fund purchasing process where some of the reform that we're having and some of the flexibility that we have with our global budget allows us to do business differently. We also have community outreach specialists that are 24/7 able to go out with our mobile crisis response team, which is new for a medium-sized community like ours to be able to build that capacity into the system so that we're working with law enforcement partners at reducing and decriminalizing individuals that don't need to be in the justice system if it truly is a mental health challenge that's driving behavior in the community. Giving law enforcement more options to call us and have us come out and evaluate and work with them on alternative placement. And lastly, we're working on our maternal medical home model care of development, which is essentially really looking at access to early prenatal services and what kind of wraparound service supports young families need, especially high-risk young families, in order to have a healthy baby at delivery and then immediately following avoid some of the pitfalls that are sometimes experienced, like postpartum depression. We have postpartum depression classes available today for new moms, and we have a variety of home visiting programs that are working in concert together to support them from OB care on to follow-up with their pediatric practice care. And the community is unified around those principles because we're really working on early learning and health integration, and that's been one of our principles that we've embraced early on. So I'll touch on payment reform. We are making some significant changes in January 2015 with the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. It's a formal mental health organization, and we will no longer be subcapitating our primary behavioral health services through that organization. We're actually planning for local system management through the CCO in partnership with the county and the community providers to put risk more local and at the provider level where we can. So it's really establishing a value-based purchasing model where we're paying for outcomes and where we're making sure that the delivery system has enough skin in the game that they feel that there's some risk and reward, and that the CCO is managing the total budget more closely than subcapitating out to an external partner. That said, we've had a wonderful partnership with the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, but I think it's important to touch on the change because it does signal a major change in the players. It's not just rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, so to speak. We're also doing that with primary care, and we made an early commitment and have reinvested money into primary care alternative payment models as well, and it's a lot of what's allowing us to have better primary care access in the community today, and we do have access for nearly all of our members are assigned today, and the few that aren't are typically not assigned yet because of complex care issues that we're managing through. And that's really been a community effort. So, you know, lastly, I think the future is intensive home and community-based service supports. It's really working out into the communities locally with schools, doing mental health first aid, which is one of the evidence-based models that we're embracing statewide. Our Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs is working on bringing that statewide, and it's really giving schools, communities, congregations, faith-based response more tools to help young people and their families before they ever get into a crisis situation. And that intersection of early learning, health, nutrition, and support for high-risk families is one example of how our medical system partners are starting to think and behave differently. So we really hope that every healthcare provider, every early learning advocate, social service provider, educator, judge, parent, coach, community member will understand the value of limiting these adverse childhood experiences in order to reduce that downstream high-cost care or improve the chance of a young person in their opportunity for quality education and quality life. So that knowledge is really driving how we are starting to think about early trauma and investments that we make to reduce chronic disease, which is a different way of thinking than a health plan prior to CCOs. So I would really highlight the need to select wise population health improvement strategies going forward for all CCOs. And if we look at social determinants and what things we're doing concretely in Yamhill, we can really point to how before CCOs, there were publicly funded healthcare services in many silos, and we weren't really producing the integrated care that focuses on population health. And today, I don't think we can ignore intervention, early intervention, as a way to improve community health or mental well-being. So it's really what we're doing, I think, is that collective impact model where you measure, you set a goal, you define that shared vision, you start to measure your progress towards those goals, but it comes down to those alignment issues of local resource and human capital and who has what and what part of the community can be leveraged, and it must be local, and it's grassroots, and that really should be what's driving stewardship of public fund decisions. And
That's great.
At the heart of it comes quality of life for the members.
You've missed some great opportunities to quit.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop here. That is really good. Thank you, Chair.
It's an extraordinary story you're telling. I really hate to
cut
you
off.
This is amazing.
If we could, one thing that they've done in Yamhill County is they've been very active in going out and getting the private sector involved in a lot of the things. They're working with the churches and different groups that are out there, and they have a lot of participant from the community in making it happen. And that's the thing that's impressed me with what our commissioners were doing, what Silas has done, that I haven't seen in any other CCO. So it truly is a community-based program, and how I feel all of them should be.
Okay. All right. We need to move on. We're really running out of time. Let's have Jeff and then a couple of short questions. But that is an amazing story, I must say. Well told. Did you have something you wanted to
say? No, I basically wanted to say that because you hit on like
every
early intervention,
point.
Maternal and child health, addictions, depression, and I was thinking about your previous question.
Non-professional care.
About how do we cover the costs that we will increasingly have to pick up, and you think about what one foster child cost in the child welfare system, and if you can prevent one kid, but I mean with this strategy, so then you talk about, you know, the traditional health care workers and the peer wellness coordinators, which was a bill that we passed last year, the Traditional Healthcare Workers Commission. So, I mean, you just hit on everything we've been striving to do, and I know the good work in my own community, but it's an unbelievable story. It's really, at some point, I wish we had time to hear about your community advisory council and your dental health integration. I know we don't have time for that, but incredible story.
Dr. Hetherington.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Health Plans. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to testify.
We're happy to have you.
Am I done now? I just want
to. It's a great way to quit.
No.
Now, are there any questions of Dr. Hetherington?
That's called quitting while you're ahead.
Best testimony all day.
I hope everybody else can model that experience.
I will make just a few quick remarks. Number one, I cannot echo enough what was said here about early childhood education and early childhood development, I think is a better term. That is, some of it is healthcare related. Some of it is behavioral related. A lot of it is community and education. And, you know, the health profile of the individual is pretty well set by the time they're six. And CCOs don't see them much between the time they're one and six. So, you know, there's where the community has to come in. When you get right down to it. I mean, we see the outliers. We see the kids that are sick, the behavioral problems and that. But, you know, the majority of those kids, they don't need health care, or it doesn't show up as a need, you know, until much later. And so, you know, I think the next big step is to take a good hard look at what we're doing with kids in terms of their overall development. And, you know, it really doesn't lie in the CCO's purview in many cases, but it lands there later, and you know, either in adolescence or later in their adult lives. So I'd just put a plug in for that. I'd say in the for those of you that haven't heard me talk before, and there may be one person back there. The family care has been doing integrated mental and physical health care since 96. So what we saw with the advent of the CCO world was, number one, a subtle shift, I would say, in cooperation with the counties. We had pretty good working relationships with them to begin with, but it sort of like got up on the plane and started to sail nicely with the advent of CCOs. The other thing that's happened in the Portland metropolitan area is that health share and family care, Janet Meyer and I arrived at a very early agreement that we were gonna collaborate on the community-wide services. I mean, we have our own networks and we have our own providers, but there are some services that we share across the board, and that if we could collaborate and not try and, you know, reinvent the wheel, each of us, that would work much smoother, not only for us, but also for the providers and the patients. And that has gone, I think, very smoothly. That's not to say that we're done, because there's a lot of pieces to put together. Being just about 2 years into this, there's still a lot of pieces to put together. And it's a matter of time. But I think that has worked really well, and I think it speaks well for the collaboration between the two organizations and, you know, and the multiplicity of providers that were down below us. One of the things that family care did that I'll highlight, insurance companies tend to be just as siloed as everybody else, with the claims department, a customer service department, then you have mental health here, and over in the other building you have physical health, and so on. We've totally changed our structure and developed integrated service teams. So each integrated service team is assigned to a specific group of physical health primary care providers and the patients associated with them. And so when the calls come in from either the patients or the providers, they get the same team every time. And so we have multiple teams throughout the company. And what we're doing with that is building a pretty strong working relationship at each level. And so when either a patient calls in or a provider calls in, they're going to get the same team. They're going to get the same people who know how those providers practice. We've got two teams assigned to all of our pediatricians, for instance. And they know, you know, the kind of clientele they have, and they're able to work with them and whoever else, you know, that they tend to work with in the specialty community and in the behavioral health community. We just put those in place in January 1. The providers are extremely receptive to it. They've been very positive about the fact that, gee, now we don't have to call and get someone and go through the same story every time. They know what we're talking about. They know how we work. And so far that has been a real positive.
Who's on the teams? What's the makeup of those teams?
The teams, we have our customer service people, which we now call navigators. We have representatives from our claims department. We have the behavioral health providers, our internal behavioral health service people, registered nurses for physical health. We have a dental person who is shared with a number of teams, and we also have our pharmacy group, which is shared with several teams. So, and then they meet on a regular basis internally in the morning to go over, okay, who are the high flyers, you know, what are the issues we're having within each pod, as what we're calling them right now, to talk about, you know, what the workflow needs to look like, particularly with a group I didn't identify, which is our service coordinators. Service coordinators are the people who both internally and externally work with either providers getting patients to care or with patients who tend to be have a little need for more what we'd call discipline navigation to get to their providers, to stay out of the ERs and that kind of services. People have trouble with transportation, health, child care, and so on. They're missing appointments, essentially. That's a thumbnail sketch on that. I would say the two big issues I think that we have in integration, number one is the underpayment and shortage in behavioral health. You know, that's going to have to be addressed. If we get all the people that need behavioral health services, you know, either at what you may want to call a primary care level or an upper specialty care level, we're probably going to run out of people pretty quickly. And that is because, you know, we pay mental health very poorly, and we have very little way of determining what's effective and what's not effective. You know, they're sort of, we look at the outliers to make those determinations. The other thing that's laying out there, particularly in terms of county services, is the wraparound funds. Wraparound funds are not included in the CCO budget. This is not a plea for them to do so. But somehow, there is a need to address that, because I know the counties, and they can speak for themselves, but, you know, there are a lot of services out there they're worried about. Okay, what happens to those wraparound funds? How do we pay for the safety net services, the safety services, you know, without dipping in, as some were doing, into the county mental health budgets? And that needs to be addressed. So with that, I'll close, and if there's any questions, be glad to answer.
I really do appreciate that. What we've heard, and it's not from either of your counties, is that there are people that have been treated in the county mental health system, and then they're not in the county mental health system, but they can't find that they've been treated in the CCO. So there's this worry about some gap between them. I mean, I think the fact that you have your department integrated into it is, but it's something that we want to be mindful of and be on top of, and we'll be asking the CCOs to keep an eye on this one, because it's something that's very, very important. We don't want people to get lost in that global budget transition business. So.
Well, if they got treated under the Medicaid program, the bills flow into us, so we know that they were treated either on either side, and I would imagine most of the CCOs have the same. If they're paying for the services.
Representative Thompson, do you have a brief question?
Yeah, just very specifically as an example, how do you handle a Medicaid-qualified meth addict walking through the door, and that's going to be happening because they're going to get transferred out of the judicial system into the healthcare system under the Affordable Care Act. We have a dismal success rate with those people. How do they fit into this coordinated system?
Right, you're going to meet up.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, were you directing that at me, Representative?
No,
It's a class of people we have out there in the community that are largely untreated. They're enormous social obstacles to success, and yet they're part of the Affordable Care Act now. And eventually we're going to have to deal with them as individuals with names attached.
Two concrete examples. So one is we have a enhanced high-risk drug court that we operate in Yamhill County, and our presiding judge, John Collins, is a wonderful leader, and many years ago started our specialty courts, and we've been fortunate to build on them each year. One of the programs that we run is a partnership with corrections, and it's funded through a federal grant that's ending, and it pays for APO and 2 substance abuse counselors, and we provide service to 40 to 45 high risk, and these are medium to high risk to reoffend populations in this drug court model. And what we've found is that 23 of the 40 enrolled are now eligible for the health plan, and as our federal funds expire to provide the treatment court, we now have an access point to provide intensive outpatient treatment, many of whom are methamphetamine addicts. And we've built on a evidence-based model over the years that has a strong partnership with local law enforcement and other healthcare partners. So we're really looking at intensive service and supports for these individuals. But let me tell another concrete example of a woman that just was in the jail, because I read an email this morning about it. And it was an early success story. She's 4 months pregnant. She's now got 60 days clean. But when we first were called into the jail to evaluate her, she was saying, "Keep me in jail. I can't stay clean. I've been using for the last 4 months. I got this baby. I want the baby. I can't stay clean. Keep me in jail." Well, we couldn't keep her in jail. Wasn't under the law. Wasn't allowable. And she was released. We got her same day access to a counselor, a certified recovery mentor, coach that was working with her. We got her into subsidy housing temporarily, and started working in intensive outpatient. Well, she's got 60 days clean now. Just went to her checkup with the baby, has a name for the baby. I don't want to share too much, but the email came with the name of the baby. She's 6 months, the little baby, and had a great, well, you know, prenatal care appointment. And, you know, we're hoping that those, and she's enrolled in our health plan now. She wasn't when we first interfaced with her. So it's that kind of outreach where I think, to Mr. Hetherington's point, you know, having partnerships with county community-based providers and the public safety system and your local CCO, you start to connect these publicly funded systems of care and the resource that we need to share and allocate properly to support whether it's a high-risk drug court offender population that now has access to treatment. By the way, many of those 23 have come back and said, "Thank you so much. I now can go and get health services that I didn't get access to before." These are typically adults that weren't covered prior to the Affordable Care Act. So those are a couple examples. Thank you.
I'm going to call time. We're running out of time. We have 3 more presentations. Thank you very much for your work. It was great to hear from both of you. Can we spend 3 to 5 minutes talking about the question of direct entry midwives and their relationship with the CCOs? Literally 5 minutes. Somebody want to talk about that?
Did you want to? What are you hoping for us?
No, I haven't.
We weren't prepared for that.
I don't want to give you another chance to start going.
Well, I'll tell you.
Very wise. Thank you very much.
I told you Silas was good.
Great.
He stayed at a Holiday Inn last night, too.
Chair Greenluck and members of the committee, my name is Dana Harganani, and I serve as the Child Health Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and I will keep this very brief. I had the opportunity to staff a work group under the Oregon Health Authority over the last 4 months. So between January and April of this year, OHA convened a direct entry midwife staff advisory work group with the request that the work group provide recommendations back to the Director of the Oregon Health Authority regarding perinatal services provided to Medicaid enrollees by direct entry midwives. Again, just very briefly, our final report has just been completed, and I will be happy to share that with the committee after,
please,
so you have further details. I would say overall that the committee, the work group was a huge success. It included 10 work group members. The chair was Dr. Duncan Nielsen, obstetrician at Legacy. It included 3 direct entry midwives, CCO representatives, certified nurse midwives, and other obstetric physicians. Ultimately, the work group really focused on thinking about how direct entry midwife services could be integrated into the coordinated care model in Oregon, and specifically focused on child and maternal health outcomes, as well as managing and balancing options in prenatal services and individual choice. Ultimately, the work group put forward 8 consensus-based recommendations that are squarely under the authority of the Oregon Health Authority, as well as a set of recommendations that the health authority could support. I think one of the highlights that was acknowledged during this work group's convening was recognizing that affordable liability coverage continues to be a significant barrier to the integration of direct entry midwife services in the coordinated care model. So ultimately, those 8 recommendations sought to think about a phased-in approach of how we can move towards that given those immediate barriers with liability coverage. So I would just highlight perhaps 2 of the main upfront recommendations that came forward, and then we'll open up for questions and share the report with you. One of the first recommendations that OHA is moving forward is to provide a fee-for-service opt-in option for women who choose direct entry midwife services, since that cannot be obtained currently within a coordinated care organization. The second, and goes along with the first, is that we will adopt a set of high-risk criteria. Basically, we will apply those, and a woman who would choose to have services, perinatal services, provided by a direct entry midwife would have to meet a low-risk criteria. So those high-risk criteria would be applied to decide whether Medicaid reimbursement would be available for those perinatal services. Those are pretty extraordinary conversations that this work group has, and, are, like I said, a very professional, wonderful consensus-based set of recommendations that came out of it. So I will pause for time's sake. I'm happy to answer any questions about the work group.
I'll just say I'm ecstatic about the work that you did and fabulous staffing and the fact that you got consensus, because I know how hard that is. Half of the people on your workforce were the work group were the ones on mine, and Sandy accompanied me on that process. I think it's fabulous outcomes, and I think it's very reasonable that we allow people choice and yet say, you know, for the state to take on reimbursing, we are going to direct people toward a low-risk model. So that means that Oregon Health Plan will reimburse for the prenatal care of high-risk births only if they're in a hospital. That's basically what the main finding was. Okay. So I think it's fabulous work.
Please make that report available to us.
We absolutely will.
Sally did a great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. I'll close the work session on CCOs and call a panel, open a work session on the Oral Health Funders Coalition. Welcome you. We'll try and keep it to 15 minutes instead of 20 if that works. After this, we're going to have a presentation on the Oregon Medical Board's administrative rules, working on solving a problem we asked them to solve, and we're very excited about that. And finally, we'll have a brief report on the task force we put in place on the future of public health. So please introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of committee. My name is Melissa Freeman. I work for the Oregon Community Foundation as the Director of Strategic Projects. And the Oregon Community Foundation is a member of the Oral Health Funders Collaborative. This is a partnership of 10 of our region's leading philanthropic organizations. We formed in 2011. Basically to raise awareness of oral disease and promote best practices to improve oral health for all Oregonians. Over the past decade, many volunteers, donors, and staff at our various organizations have learned about the hidden epidemic of oral disease among Oregonians, and we have been really motivated to act. We've learned about the connections between oral health and education, health and well-being, the value of prevention for reducing costly emergency department visits, and we've learned about the barriers that keep people from accessing dental services, either from a shortage of providers in rural communities, too few dentists who serve people on Medicaid, cultural barriers, fear of dental pain, lack of insurance, and much more. We've also learned about the importance of delivering services to children where they are, in schools and in well child visits. And so we're motivated to act. The reason we're here, again, is to raise awareness. Oregon ranks as one of the worst states in the nation for oral health. Just want to point out briefly all these different partners who make the collaborative here. And then here are some of the statistics for Oregon. Only 33% of Oregonians ages 33 through 44, so younger adults, have all of their teeth. only 50, actually over 56% of children 6 to 8 years old, so this is first through third graders, have serious dental decay. And in a recent Oregon Smile survey in 2012, we learned that 17,000 kids have rampant decay, which means 7 or more teeth are affected with cavities. It's the most common chronic childhood disease, with rates 5 times higher than that of asthma. Children with poor oral health are nearly 3 times more likely to miss school. And nationally, children miss more than 51 million school hours each year due to dental pain. We call it a hidden epidemic because often it looks like the child is fine from the outside, but when you open the mouth, you see this rampant decay. And many of the students, I'll just throw in there, many of the students, when they do get some help or some treatment, make comments such as, I've never owned my own toothbrush, or I didn't know that my mouth didn't have to hurt. So this is what we're motivated to do, is to try to help Oregonian children. The statistics and the rising need we see in our various grant programs mobilized our funders collaborative to commission a study on the use of emergency departments for dental pain. I'll let Dr. Mike Plunkett tell you about the results.
Chairman Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Mike Plunkett, and I am the Senior Director for Dental Care Delivery at Kaiser Permanente, 8 weeks into the job. For the sake of this subject, my past experience was as Dental Director of Care Oregon and as Dental Director of Federally Qualified Community Health Center, Neighborhood Health Center in the Portland metro area. I'm also on the faculty at OHSU in the Department of Community Dentistry, where I direct a course series in public health and health policy. The study she was referring to has been recently released, and it was commissioned by the Funders Collaborative, and it was conducted by researchers at the Oregon Health Science University and the University of Washington. And they looked at ED utilization in the state of Oregon in 2010. And there were four specific things that came out of this study. Just at a higher level, I'll tell you that the value of the study to many of us involved with this is it formalizes one piece of what many of us have known who treat the population and have been advocating on behalf of this subject for some time. It simply formalizes some of the major issues that run through our system and the lack of coordination across the medical and dental delivery system. But the four major points that came out of the study is that emergency department visits for dental conditions are common. And some perspective on that is in 2010, about 28,000 people reported to Oregon emergency departments for dental care issues, dental services. And that in the age group of 20 to 39 year old, that represents the second most common discharge diagnosis in Oregon emergency departments. And there's a very strong correlation between being uninsured, or it's causative, uninsured, or being on the Oregon Health Plan. There's a disproportionate number of those individuals that end up in the emergency department for their care. So it's common. And as I said, this study simply formalizes what many of us have known for years in that regard. The second is that the utilization of the emergency department, like with mental illness, reflects issues with access to care. And that there are many ways to look at that. It could be something as simple as the lack of available dentists to see these patients in a given geographic area. It could be lack of appropriate payment to access the delivery system. Could be just the fact that there's no care coordination between hospital and medical delivery system and dental care providers in the area. And the third thing that is, and it's vitally important, is that about 60% of the patients who walk into an emergency department with dental pain as a causative reason get a narcotic of some type, an opiate of some type, and many get an antibiotic, but most, up to 60%, get a narcotic. And that's an issue that goes well beyond just dental pain. We know that in many of our communities that opiate addiction and opiate diversion is a huge problem. And the lack of a system between our hospitals and dental providers is exacerbating that problem. And the fourth major issue is that that this obviously introduces cost and raises the cost of health care. This state has taken great strides and gone through a lot of work to rearrange its Medicaid payment system into coordinated care organizations, and I think this is one of many issues that demonstrates how the lack of coordination across the various silos in our healthcare system introduce cost, risk, unnecessary pain, suffering, et cetera, into the overall system. And one specific policy recommendation that came out of the study is that, you know, this was commissioned 2 years ago, and it took some very competent researchers who've done this work before, a significant amount of time to put this together, mainly because it was so hard to get the data. Because in all claims, all payer data system in this state, uninsured in the ED, if the hospital system doesn't want to give you that information, you just won't get it. And so that's a big issue. And that was a big point of frustration. I was interviewed on this study and reviewed parts of it. I did some work about 2 years ago to develop a direct redirection program with Providence Milwaukee Hospital, and got to see firsthand how difficult some of these issues to work through are and how much challenge there are, and that's why I was interviewed. But the researchers, when I spoke with them, they discussed how easy the research is to do if you have the data, but getting the data was almost impossible, and some of it was just aggregate data and they had to extrapolate numbers from. But with that, I'll finish and open for any questions.
Unless you have some couple more comments. So another reason we're here today is just to make sure that you're aware that the Funders Collaborative is working very closely with the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Oral Health Coalition, which is made up of many representatives from the dental care organizations, the Oregon Dental Association, the Hygiene Association, et cetera. We're all working. We've been working over the past year and a half to develop a strategic plan for oral health for the next 6 years. And one of the things that has risen to the top of importance is instituting in statute a dental director for Oregon. Currently, we don't have a dental director. I know OHA is working to hire this person, but that person is critical in terms of overseeing this integration of dental into the CCO and setting some standards for community programs across the state. Another thing is,
I'd like to point out to OHA representatives who are still here,
yes,
that I think this is a very important issue. It's one we're going to stay on top of, and I hope you'll be prepared to report in September about how it's going, because I was appalled to find out we don't have a state dental director.
And we're one of the few states that don't, is that right?
Finally, to wrap up, thank you for your time, and we look forward to working with you as partners going forward so that we have stronger infrastructure in the state, that we can implement the strategic plan, and we will do that most effectively with a powerful dental director. Thank you.
Will you share the strategic plan document you have with our committee again, please?
Chair Greenlick, we would really love to bring it to you in September and share some key points.
That'd be great.
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
I want to thank you for your work. Both Representative Greenlick and I have served on the board of Northwest Health Foundation, one of your partners, so it's been great working with you. I am proud to claim you as my constituent. I know you've done a lot of great public health and prevention work.
I'll never run for your seat, I promise.
I tried to get Mike to run.
I have to say that so he won't.
No, I tried to get him to run for the Senate.
Oh, wow. But what I was going to say is one of the questions I wanted to ask earlier of the CCOs, but we ran out of time, was that it's easy to identify the high flyers by who's in the emergency rooms all the time. But what I'm really interested in is how the CCOs are trying to get to the people who will become the high flyers. And one of those categories is this. As you say, it's a silent disease, and so sometimes it takes years of neglect of care for those things to show up. So whether it's children who might otherwise look healthy, but they're not doing the prevention needed for lifelong good oral health, or whether it's women who have not even become pregnant yet. So they might appear very healthy, but we want to get to them earlier so we can ask the one key question, do you plan to get pregnant or not? If you do plan to get pregnant, we've got to make sure that we're up on the prevention because of the inflammation from bad oral health that causes bad birth outcomes. Right. So those are the kinds of things that the silent things that, you know, we need to go upstream. We're dealing with the high flyer population now because that's the most obvious. But the others are equally costly down the line. And so I'm really curious about how CCOs, that was one of the questions I was going to try to ask.
Right. Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm okay. Sorry. It's actually, it's not a question. It's just a comment. I noticed that because I started reading the newspaper again.
I don't recommend it.
On May 22nd, there was an article in the bulletin that is squarely on point to this, and I'll get a printout of it. I'm reading it online right now, but just kind of a shout out to Central Oregon because between 2011 and 2013, the number of dental-related ER visits to St. Charles Bend dropped by 30%. And it was mostly coordination between local dentists, mainly Advantage Dental, which is headquartered in Redmond, and St. Charles Hospital.
Ben tends to lead the way on some of these issues. That's true.
Well, we have clean teeth anyway.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And thank you. Can I get your card before
you go? Sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Can I, Chairman Greenlee,
sure.
Can I make one comment about Representative Conger and your statements? Is that both your concerns and passion around the things that you spoke of and the article which I read today as well underscore the need for a well-placed dental director in the state to identify best practices and bring the appropriate constituents on board and standardize some of our processes. So we shouldn't have to hear it. I'm glad that I heard it from you, but we should, if it's well designed and it's working, it should raise to the priority at the state level of best practice. And we don't have anything in place to do that now. We're fragmented. There's a lot of autonomy and good things that come out of the way we do things in Oregon, but there are also a lot of good programs that simply stay in one region and then fizzle out. And that's why that underscores the need for a well-placed, authoritative dental director that can really make the connections and build the constituencies toward taking these programs to the rest of the state.
You have some people listening who can make a difference.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing on the Dental Funders Collaborative. And before I move forward, make a couple of announcements. Do you want to receive that?
Right. You just... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we received a letter from the Oregon Health Authority on May 6th notifying both the House and the Senate committees that as required by House Bill 2134 that passed in 2013, there was a report to be made on the race, ethnicity, language, and disability data report. That is a little off of their timeline. They will be, so the letter is to notify us that it's off the timeline. They would like to present that report at our September meeting.
Great. We'll
so
accept
that's for
that.
The record. Yes.
Thank you for the record. I also announced we have ready to go in place now a task force I announced several months ago on the role of community advisory committees in the CCO movement. That's a task force led by Representative Thompson, Representative Lively. The chairs have met. We'll be announcing the members of that within a week or so. Is that right? Our administrator has a list of people that she'll be working with you on, and we'll get that moving. Thank you very much for meeting on that. Let me open a public hearing on the Oregon Medical Board's adoption of an administrative rule that was pretty much in response to us badgering them to do it. So it's always nice to hear when somebody does something we want them to do. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick. My name is Kathleen Haley, members of the committee, and I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Medical Board. With me this afternoon is Dr. Joe Thaler, who is our Medical Director. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify about the Oregon Medical Board's office-based surgery rules, which classify levels of office-based surgery and set corresponding requirements, and they're based on the level of sedation that's being administered to the patient. The board is dedicated to protecting the health, safety, and well-being of Oregonians. And we have had office-based surgery rules since 2006, but they needed to be updated. So in 2011, the board began extensive research, review, and public input into the existing rules and how to update them. The recent adoption of the rules is really a culmination of that deliberative process of the board and stakeholders. We did a lot of research looking at what other states do as well as national standards, and we got input from a number of our stakeholders, including the Medical Association, the dermatological surgeons, the plastic surgeons, and several other national and other specialty groups. As I said, the rules do classify office-based surgeries according to the levels of sedation, and we also set some requirements based on those. And they categorize the level, for example, level one would be essentially no anesthesia. And the rules clarify the assessment, the informed consent procedures required, the patient medical records, what needs to be in them, our concern about emergency care should there be an untoward event in one of these offices, because remember, these are not in hospitals and not in ambulatory surgical centers. So we want to have the physician have a process in place for the immediate transfer when there's a high level of sedation being administered. They also address the issues of Botox and lasers, which I know has been your concern, Mr. Chair. Specifically, in the rule, it says the injection of a medication or substance for cosmetic purposes is the practice of medicine. So Botox and those types of procedures would be considered part of medical care. The provision was also discussed with all the other health boards, and there were no objections to the rules. Further, the rules do define office-based surgery as the performance of any surgical invasive procedure, and it goes on to specifically list laser surgery and the use of lasers that penetrate the skin. So again, we're addressing that other concern that you had around lasers. And finally, we do see occasionally complaints about the unlicensed practice of medicine. And what we do in those types of cases is investigate as we would in any other case. However, we do have limited resources, and our statutory authority is limited in terms of being able to discipline a person who is not a licensee. So in those cases, we will send a letter to them telling them that it is the practice of medicine, and we will also refer the case to the district attorney's office. In conclusion, the board continues to review these office-based surgery rules to ensure patient safety. And additionally, if it would be beneficial, the board would certainly be open to having civil penalties for the unlicensed practice of medicine in order to allow us to move more expeditiously and also in a more cost-effective way. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, or Dr. Thaler.
Well, could I ask you to work with our administrator and a legislative council to perhaps draft the possibility of a committee bill to give you that authority?
Absolutely.
And there's also the issue that some of these people may be doing it in the context of another occupation. Mm-hmm. And I would assume in those cases you might, I mean, let's say a nurse was doing it without physician authority, I assume you might deal with a board of nursing or a esthetician. I'm not sure what that term is. You might deal with their board for sanctions as well as yours. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that's correct. We would refer to those boards.
I can't tell you how delighted I am that you're defining these things as a practice of medicine, as it obviously seemed to me that they always were. And we'll continue to be diligent to keep the practice of medicine under the close supervision of physicians. It would be very useful. Any other comments? Well, thank you very much for bringing this. Happy to put it on our record as where you are and to work with you to get this civil authority, which I think would be very useful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on administrative rule
847-017-0000-0040, which was the official title of this, and open up a public hearing on getting an updated report on the task force on the future of public health. We have the chief of staff and the vice chair of the task force here. Thank you very much. We've actually gotten ahead of time.
Yeah.
Most amazing. Please don't take the whole half hour.
20 to 5.
I'm feeling pressure now on the whole time. So you'll do that. There you go. Lillian has saved me from having to use my left hand, and I appreciate it. So my name is Liz Baxter, Chair of Greenlake and members of the committee. Tammy Bainey, who is the chair of the task force, wishes that she could have been here, but her schedule didn't allow that. So as the co-chair of the task force, I'm here to give you kind of a progress update on the future of public health services task force and how we've been meeting. So just to remind us all, House Bill 2348, which was introduced in 2013, would have created 8 public health regions in the state. And as it was amended, it instead created a task force to study the future of public health services in Oregon and to make some recommendations to come back to you for legislation. And our report is due to you in October of 2014. And our charge was to really look at designing a public health system for the future. And the concepts that are on this slide are all items that were taken directly from the legislation. So these have been the things that have been shaping our discussion and our objectives as we've moved forward. The membership, appointed by the governor and the director of the Oregon Health Authority. As you can see, we've kind of got a broad swath of constituents, folks from nonprofits, public health departments from around the state, physicians, county, and elected officials. We've had some very lively discussion, and I think we've had some broad perspectives that have been a part of the work that we've been doing. So far, our meetings have kind of been in 2 batches. The first meetings, we started meeting in January, and we really spent kind of the first several meetings getting grounded, trying to find a way for the members of the task force to have a shared understanding of what public health in Oregon looks like today. And so we were looking at, from the county perspective, from the state perspective, really just kind of a broad grounding so that we would know where we were trying to move from. And then the next slide. And our more recent meetings have actually begun to shift our focus to how do we actually get to a transformed public health system looking forward. And so we've begun to look at models from other places, some of the literature, and that has led us to a discussion about shaping a straw model proposal. So this slide, which, you know, we may probably come back to, is a visual representation of our current thinking. It's actually based on work of several reports that have come out of the Institute of Medicine outlining what the core elements might be of a public health system. And this visual is actually based on some work that was done in Washington State, where they've been actually taking the Institute of Medicine recommendations and trying to find a way to operationalize it. It is a straw concept, and it's got kind of 3 components to it. The piece across the bottom, what are some of the core kind of capacities that we feel need to be present everywhere, and then across those boxes that are along, kind of in the different colors along the top, what are some of the programmatic areas that are foundational programs in public health? And we wanted something that was both in concept and construct and visually that would further some discussion, kind of spark some dialogue among members of the task force, and help us to have something as we continue to look at and refining and revising this model. And so the timeline that we have looking forward, we are actually, and we made some decisions at our last meeting that all of our meetings have been open to the public, and we've actually had people from the public giving us comment all along the way. But we wanted to have a strategy for actively soliciting some input to this straw model. And so we've come up with some timelines, and that's what's laid out before you, because we know that we've got this October deadline to bring something to you in terms of recommendation and a report back to you. So during the summer, we've identified some groups that we're going to be reaching out to and presenting this model and using their input to help refine this as we move forward. So with that, if there are questions, Lillian is here as the executive sponsor of the task force, and if there are really detailed questions, I'm just going to go. But if you have questions about the task force or the process, we'd be happy to hear those now.
Yes.
Thank you for coming. I'm a public health person, so I'm delighted that you're here. I vaguely remember that we are something like 47th out of 50th in per capita spending, state spending on public health, and that almost all of your dollars are federal grant dollars, so you're kind of going grant by grant as opposed to an investment from the state in public health. Am I remembering this correctly?
Actually, that's correct.
Lillian.
Chair Greenlink. Oh, Lillian Shirley, Oregon Health Division, Public Health Division Director. That's correct, Representative. And as we looked at, went through a lot of the financial background, you know, for what is actually paying for what, you are absolutely correct. There is a lot of federal dollars that come down that are program specific. Mm-hmm. But additionally, the state does put money in general fund dollars. And our local jurisdictions also support their public health programming and infrastructure in the local counties as well. And they put a lot of money into that as well. So it's really the system. Everyone is like contributing a certain part. We are actually not 47th, 46th.
Mm, got a little better. Oh, okay. I'm very curious when you get to July in terms of sustainable funding. That'll be a big piece of, you know, I hope you can do some good thinking and come back to us with some proposals.
Any other questions?
Follow up on Representative Kenny Geyer. Is there places where efforts might be duplicated, though? Because I haven't seen a huge health issue in the state of Oregon, unless I'm missing something. I mean, are some of the local counties absorbing or doing some of these things that other states are handling through their public health system, or... Basically, are we duplicating efforts, or is it things being taken care of locally through local counties or other state programs and things like that?
My opinion, Representative Wiener, is that we really have a system here, and there isn't really that duplication. There's really almost like a quilt where different parts of the state have very different needs. You know, and part of the responsibility, I think, of the state public health division is to provide the data and the epidemiology and the analysis of what is needed where and what are the differences in the local conditions, and then work very closely with the counties and their structure. We meet monthly with all of the local health administrators. We have all these subcommittees. You know, we don't do anything at the state, like around, say, IT and public health, without bringing it to the local, the Conference of Local Health Officials IT Committee. We've just had a couple of policy recommendations through other separate committees. So I really think that one of the advantages that we have here in Oregon, in concert with what we're trying to do with transformation with the CCOs, is we really are working together to identify what is needed and who is best to do the response. A number of areas around the state actually have not-for-profits that are, you know, working, that they are the mechanism to provide the services that are needed in a county, along with the public health authority that the governmental public health structure has in the counties. That being said, I think everybody is really committed to looking at what needs to be done, what needs and to be paid for, and how can we have some kind of a consensus on how we organize ourselves to do that work. And I think that's kind of where we are. That's what the straw model is really about. You know, it's not a proposal. It's something to get people to think about, you know, what is being done and how is it being done and what are we paying for. So I don't know if that answered your question.
As a member of that task force, though, the thing it seems to me that's obvious is not that we're duplicating services. It's if you look at a modern statement about what a public health system looks like, we're nowhere near providing that in any uniform way across the state. It's very much a quilt is a good way. It's a catch-as-catch-can model. And the counties are the official public health authorities, but many counties don't have the money to provide a jail. I mean, it's things are really getting tough, and the extent to which we depend on either CDC grants to do, say, communicable disease or chronic disease, and local funding, which is getting less and less available, the future, I think, looks very bleak when you look at those charts that show what a well-rounded system is. I mean, we're not close.
A lot of these programs, when I look at them, a lot of the issues are communication. And how do you close that gap of communication? I mean, if everybody's talking and working together, you can do a lot more with less. And that's what I was kind of trying to get at, because it looks like things are happening, you know, for the state of Oregon. We do have counties that are hurting. A lot of our timber counties, you get into rural Oregon, that's where the big issues are. Portland, you just have E. coli in your water, so it's a different issue.
That's only in Representative Kenny Geyer's district.
The public health person.
So if I could add a piece, I think that part of what we learned during those first meetings is that things happen differently depending on which county you're talking about. But we also heard a lot about counties that share resources, that are already moving to, you know, sharing an epidemiologist or borrowing staff and, you know, doing programs across some of those county lines. And I think that that was really helpful for us to hear some of the creativity that's happening, you know, on the ground. You know, this model, and one of the things that one of our presenters talked about was, you know, how do we move from what needs to happen in our county to what would we like to know is actually there on the ground in the counties that surround us. And I think that's what has been appealing about this straw model is, you know, that we're really talking about how do we actually, you know, figure out what should be in place across the state. And so I think, you know, we've had some lively discussion around what are the CCOs responsible for, what are the county public health folks responsible for, and, you know, as this continues to be refined, I think we will have even more robust discussion.
Exactly. And if I, Representative Greenlick, if I can just add, you heard from Silas earlier, and I think, you know, what we're hearing is that a lot of this work is happening, you know, that's what we have to respect, that, you know, like all of our transformation efforts, it really has to be, you know, this is what we want for the outcomes for everyone here in our state. But, you know, you have to figure it out according to your local conditions. And then how do we make sure that there's equity and fairness across the whole state, mm-hmm. regardless of sources of funding, to make sure that that can happen for everybody. So I think that's kind of where we are. And I think the Yamhill County is a great example. We have others, Lincoln County, you know, where the work that's being done on the local level is really solving the problems and setting priorities there. Then there's always, you know, the drinking water, you know, and restaurant inspections and emergency preparedness, you know, and the data. The state will always, you know, have to, you know, be there for local communities with a number of things. I mean, we could go through the whole list, but that's kind of what we're trying to get out with these foundational capabilities, and then what are the programs that emanate from them. And then other counties can do whatever they want. You know, they can keep going and add more services. But as my chair said, my vice chair said, we have great leadership with the chair and vice chair, and, you know, they've really kept us on task to how do we get a deliverable product, you know, so that the legislature can, you know, debate it and understand it and, you know, make a decision.
I think at the local level, one of the problems you run into is if we make a decision and dictate it to them, is what we need to do is put a plan together for them, and here's something you should be doing or could be doing, and let them attack it the way they are. Mm-hmm. It's like McDonald's. They have a formula set up, and you just drop them in, and anybody can go in and run them because it's put together that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something, as we start putting programs together, we need to look at it, doing that for our local
Absolutely.
Counties.
Absolutely. And that's one
rather
of our core
values.
Rather than
just saying, you will do this.
Right. No. That's
and it's like, I have no clue. How do I do it?
Right. We don't know how it should look.
Yeah. And who does it in different areas of the state, I think, is another thing that we've somewhat put on the table, that the resources may be different, the organizations that are present may be different. And so how do we create a model that allows some of that differences to take place on the ground?
To put just a little stress on your time frame, in order for us to ask for a legislative concept for pre-session filing, we need to have it 2 days or 3 days after our September meeting. Your report's not due till October, but if at that time you could give us a little clue about the nature of some concepts you might want to have, then we can put in a placeholder. It doesn't have to have the finished ideas. So it would be very useful for that September meeting if you could give us, say, we may have a concept that relates to sharing resources among counties. We may have one that relates to this and one that relates to that. We can get a placeholder, and then we can amend it when we actually get it. I also want to remind you all that if you have some suggestions for legislative concepts, it would be useful to have them to us if you want them to be committee bills before the September meeting, or during the September meeting would be fine, and we can ask for it right after that. Thank you very much. As a member of your commission, your task force, I can say it's been very informative. The meeting in Bend last week was very, very interesting. And
robust, I think.
Very robust.
Keep coming back to that word. Lillian was just reminding me, and we can get the link to you, that the materials from every one of the meetings are on a website, so that, you know, some of the background information that we've learned from the different counties and from the states, you know, that's all accessible in one place, so we can get that to you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on the Task Force on the Future of Public Health. And unless we have any other business coming before us, I will adjourn and release the survivors. We are adjourned.